Dr. Coleman's store. I have to run an errand, I tell James Wall, as we stand outside the tavern, but would you mind doing something for me in the meantime?
What's that?
Keep an eye on Dr. Page. I don't trust him.
Aye, Mistress Ballard. I'll stay until he's gone, James says.
The young new doctor must only verify my findings. Then the men of Hallowell can put Joshua Burgess in the ground to rot. But the ground is frozen, and nothing short of a hatchet will break it in this cold. Regardless, there likely isn't a man in three counties willing to do the job, which leaves them with a dilemma. What to do with the mangled corpse on their hands? For now they will have to wrap him in linen, then oiled canvas, and store him in the shed behind the tavern until better arrangements can be made. It did not escape my attention that Chandler Robbins, in his drunken stupor, had suggested pitching Burgess back into the river. They'd cut a hole, after all, he said. No one had paid Chandler much mind, however. And then they'd all dispersed and gone their separate ways. I leave James looking more tired than ever, and go in search of something that only Samuel Coleman can supply. Thankfully, all I must do is cross the street and turn left. The sign above the door reads Coleman's General, and it creaks in the breeze like an old gate on rusted hinges. I worry for a moment that the store is not yet open, but no sooner do I set my hand on the knob than I have to jump back as two trappers, bearded and foul-smelling, stomp out.
"Didn't give us much for them furs, did he?"
one grumbles to the other. I hold my breath as they pass. I doubt either of them has bathed in a month.
"Get that silver fox, and he will. Them's worth $20 easy. More if you can keep the head attached when you skin it. Ain't no silver fox in these woods," the second man argues.
He steps off the boardwalk and turns left toward Pollard's Tavern.
"Them's rare as virgins in a brothel. And just as expensive. But I saw one anyways, a pretty little vixen, upriver yesterday, near that mill run by the Welshman."
I watch as they shuffle across the street, shedding bits of mud and refuse as they go. Soon their voices fade to a hard grumble, and they reach the other side, no doubt to spend whatever coin they've just made at the tavern. The Welshman they speak of is my husband, and the mill belongs to us. But in the 11 years that we have lived there, I have never seen a silver fox. It bothers me that these men think they can kill something on our property and take it just because they want it. I pull the door open and step into the general store. The little bell rings above my head, and my eyes settle on the pile of new furs stacked beside the counter. 7 in total, mostly beaver, though that's a stoat near the middle, and there is a single blazing red fox pelt on top. I am struck by sudden concern for the silver fox's mate. Coleman's General was built before we moved to Hallowell, and Ephraim cannot set foot in the place without muttering about how it wasn't framed square. The roof leaks were fixed last year, however, and the townsfolk no longer need to worry about puddles in the dry goods aisle. For my part, I find the place cheerful. The windows are plentiful, the floorboards creak, and the place smells of lamp oil and dried apples. Coleman is getting older, however, and the store is starting to show signs of neglect. Cobwebs in the corners, dust piled on every windowsill. It's a lot for one man to manage on his own.
"Good morning, Mistress Ballard,"
he calls out from his perch at the till. "To you as well," I answer, then move to join him at the counter. The store is empty, except for the two of us, and he sits on a wooden stool, playing a game of chess by himself, spinning the board around as he takes turns between black and white. I've always thought checkers would be easier if the goal were to outsmart oneself, but he insists on the game of kings. Once he's taken the white rook with the black bishop, he looks up from the board. The iris of his good eye has grown milky in recent years, turning the once soft blue into a muddled kind of gray. It is less disturbing, however, than the sunken void where his other eye used to be. The man refuses to wear a patch.
It's early yet. What brings you to the hook? He asks.
A birth and a death, among other things.
He smiles, and what with his multiple deformities, the effect should be grotesque, but it is charming instead. Souls passing in the night, I take it. Who's come and gone?
Charles and Betsy Clark have another daughter, I tell him, smiling at his raised eyebrow. Then add, and someone has killed Joshua Burgess.
Ah, that's who they found in the river then.
How did you hear?
Half the town is hurt by now.
Only half? The rest are late sleepers. This is why I've taken the time to visit Samuel Coleman before heading home. Nothing happens in the hook without his knowledge. He is known in town as Dr. Coleman, though no one has ever seen him practice medicine. Nor would any trust him to do so, given that he possesses only the one eye and a total of 6 fingers, 2 on his left and 4 on his right. Theories abound as to how he lost them, ranging from reasonable war injuries to ridiculous torture by pirates. For his part, Coleman lets those in the hook think whatever they wish and never bothers to confirm or deny any of their speculations. In fact, when he chooses to speak at all, it is usually to grouse about the French claim that their literature is superior to that of their English counterparts. Whatever he holds against the French is a grudge he means to keep to himself. It is his ability to listen, however, that makes him valuable to me. But are they saying anything about who might have done it?
I'd imagine there are several men who have cause. Isaac Foster comes to mind immediately. Not to mention Joseph North, and dozens more who were known to dislike him. I've not heard a specific name, if that's what you're asking.
He winks.
But the shop ain't been open an hour yet, so give me time.
You'll tell me, though. He nods.
Several years ago, Coleman and I formed a trade agreement of sorts. Mostly we barter books and information, but occasionally household goods as well. He holds back any reading material that comes through, and I keep him stocked in candles. The gossip is free. I'll check back in a few days, I tell him. Is there anything else you need while you're here?
Just one thing.
And what's that?
What do you know about this new doctor who's come to town?
Ballard's Mill. It is late morning by the time I return home, and the winter sun is hidden behind a veil of drab clouds. The light feels weak and sickly, as though sifted through old cheesecloth. I ride Brutus through the woods and into the clearing, where I pause at a fork in the drive. Wright will take me down to the mill, where I can hear the heavy whack-whack of my husband's axe. But Left will take me up the rise to the house, where my girls are caring for Sam Dalwin. I am debating which path to take when I see the silver fox. There on the slope that leads to the south pasture, clear against the snow, is a lithe creature, almost entirely black, with piercing amber eyes. She is stunning, vicious and proud, and I'd sooner shoot one of those trappers myself than let them turn her into a fur stole. Brutus twitches beneath me, curious and on edge, however. He is no fan of tooth or claw. But the little beast neither moves nor makes a sound. After a long, lazy yawn in which her pink tongue unfurls into an S, she turns her pointed head to look up the hill toward the house, then back to me, and back to the drive. 3 times she does this, slow and certain, back and forth. Then out of nowhere, she yaps at me, sending Brutus into a wild jerk. It is a howling, barking noise, but not like a dog nor a wolf. Not the mean yip and snarl of a coyote. It is a sharp-toothed and feral sound. Caterwauling, my husband would say. Finally, the fox sniffs the air, sits back on her haunches, and licks one tufted paw, as though satisfied. She wants me to go to the house, I think.
and am so startled by the realization that I gasp. The fox lifts her head at the sound, meets my gaze again, then springs to her feet and trots toward the woods. "Stay safe, little one," I tell her, and urge Brutus up the hill. Our youngest son, Ephraim, a boy just turned 11 and named for his father, meets me at the garden gate. He reaches for the reins as I dismount Brutus. "Be careful with him," I say, unbuckling my medical bag from the saddle. "He is in rare form today." "No matter, he likes me." He shrugs, confident he will come to no harm, then flashes a smile that reveals he has lost his final baby tooth. "Still," I bend to kiss the top of his head, then gently nip the side of one ear. "He bites." Young Ephraim giggles, and I ruffle his shaggy hair as he turns toward the barn to care for my horse. It is hard to have an oldest child, but harder still to have a youngest. Soon he too will have a beard like Cyrus and an Adam's apple like Jonathan. Soon he will spend half his nights away, and that will be the end of childhood in our home. I am 54 years old, and that boy is my last. This knowledge is both a relief and a sadness. I have brought 9 children into this world, after all, and only 6 are still living. Like all mothers, I have long since mastered the art of nursing joy at one breast and grief at the other. I stand at the door watching his loping, childish gait a moment longer. Then I go into the house to check on Sam Dalwin. "How is our patient?" I ask my daughters as soon as I'm through the door. Warm air and the scent of freshly baked bread rush toward me, vanquishing the chill I've felt since leaving home in the middle of the night. "How did you know about him?" Dolly looks up, and I can see curiosity burning in her eyes. They are the same bright blue as her father's. Word travels fast. At 20 and 17, Hannah and Dolly are women, not girls, all hips and curves, racing toward their own lives and away from home. It won't be long before they outgrow me, before they outgrow their willingness to be only daughters and sisters. Soon the inevitable will happen. They'll want to be someone's wife, someone's mother. "Well," I ask, "how is he?" "Awake," Dolly says. "And hungry," Hannah adds, "and eager to go home, but we made him stay." Sam Dalwin is not a small man, nor does he seem the type to take instructions from anyone, much less young women half his size. Curious, I lift an eyebrow. Hannah stands by the fire, running flax fibers through thumb and forefinger and onto a drop spindle that swings gently near her feet. The heavy spindle twists the fibers into a line of newly formed linen thread that, when long enough, she wraps around the bobbin at its base. Given the 8 spools of thread that sit neatly on the hearth, it's clear she has been at this work all morning. A smile bobbles on her lips. Unlike her younger sister, Hannah has my eyes, wild and brown like a dust storm. No wonder Moses Pollard has fallen under her spell. "I hit his britches," she explains. In addition to having acquired the exact tone and tenor of my voice, the girls have also learned a way of speaking in which they not only finish each other's sentences, but apparently their thoughts as well. They begin another rapid-fire exchange, and I glance between them, trying to keep up. Dolly stands at the kitchen table, dressing a roast for dinner. Her dark, curly hair is tied back, her hands deft. "He was furious, wouldn't let us in the room, but then he fell asleep." Hannah also acquired my curls, but hers are flaxen instead, pulled into a braid that hangs over her shoulder. "He's been out for 2 hours, shattered with exhaustion." Dolly ties off the cut of beef with a piece of string. "Too much excitement." Laughing, I slide out of cloak and gloves, then lower my voice. "Where did you put his clothes?" Hannah nods toward my workroom and mouths, "Cedar chest." From the time they were born, the girls have been surrounded by men. Father, brothers, countless patients. And while I have never specifically trained them to deal with the more obstinate sex, the way I have trained them to stitch wounds and spin flax and cook for a small army, I am gratified to see that they are already well-versed in the fine art of managing recalcitrant patients. What time did Jonathan bring him? The girls look at each other, silently calculate the time. Close to 3, Hannah says. Maybe an hour after you left to tend Betsy Clark, Dolly interrupts. We were still asleep. As a midwife and healer, it is not uncommon for me to hear a pounding on the door in the middle of the night, accompanied by a desperate summons, a plea of some sort. I am used to waking at the drop of a pin, and my family has long since grown accustomed to being yanked from sleep to tend the needs of our neighbors. But it must have been a rude awakening this morning, because they were out late last night with their older brothers at the autumn frolic. This dance, held seasonally for the young people in our community, is the highlight of their social calendar. The girls had barely made it home before I was called away by John Cowan. They seem to be taking it all in stride, however. My daughters are more accustomed to blood and injury and mayhem than many physicians twice their age. Was Sam bad off? I ask. Dolly wipes her hands on her apron. Bad enough that he couldn't walk. Jonathan had to drag him in. It's a wonder he didn't die, I tell them. He likely would have, but Jonathan wrapped him in blankets as soon as they got him out of the water. We stripped his clothes and put him in our bed. Hannah blushes at this, then shrugs. It was still warm. Dad pulled stones from the hearth and wrapped them in blankets. We set them on either side of his head, neck, and feet. Hannah and Dolly go back and forth telling the story, like they're tossing a hot potato between them, holding on to it just long enough to give a detail or two. It took a long time for him to stop shaking. Hannah looks at her sister, eyebrow raised. Almost till sunrise, Dolly adds. Once he did, we spoon-fed him some tea. Since he held that down, we gave him broth. Didn't take long for him to fall asleep after that. They look at each other and burst out laughing. Hannah bites her bottom lip for a bit, then cackles even louder. Woke up not long ago to realize he is naked as the day he was born. Now he's steaming like a teapot. They have seen naked men often enough. My patients, mostly. Though occasionally one brother or another shamelessly bathing in the river. Not to mention young Ephraim, who must be chased down and forced to bathe, a job they are none too fond of. Both girls are typically rather sanguine about the bare human form, and I've rarely seen them gawk or blush. But I would imagine that Sam Dalwin is a rather more impressive specimen than they are used to. Nicely done, girls, I say. Then something occurs to me. Where's Jonathan? He should be back soon. Dad sent him to tell May Kimball what's happened, seeing as how she and Sam are betrothed. What about Cyrus? A brief, furtive look passes between the girls. He was up and out shortly after we got Sam to bed, said there was work to do. There is always work to be done at the mill, but I've never known any of our sons to volunteer for it after a mere 2 hours' sleep. Hannah turns back to her spindle, and Dolly wipes down the counter. Both turn curiously silent. And what's the thing I need to know but neither of you are telling me? Again, that look between them. And this time I see Hannah shake her head. Don't say it, she silently orders. But Dolly has always been a bit bolder than her big sister, and she's not yet learned to keep secrets from me. There was a fight last night at the frolic. Between who? Cyrus and Joshua Burgess. I lift my head sharply at this news. Narrow my eyes. Over what? It's my fault, Hannah says, and those stormy eyes flash. But in anger, not fear. Burgess asked me to dance and I refused. He kept after her all night, Mother, Dolly says, but it wasn't until he grabbed her arm and yanked her toward the dance floor that Cyrus went for him. The scuffle didn't last long, but Burgess landed a couple of good hits, and now Cyrus has a black eye and a split lip. He'll be fine, but I'd wager Burgess will be walking with a limp for a month. I open my mouth to answer that he won't be walking anywhere ever again, then snap it closed. The girls don't yet know he's dead, and I can't tell them until I've spoken to Ephraim. I extend one hand to my elder daughter. Let me see your arm. It's nothing, she says, turning back to her work.
Hannah!
A single word, a definitive order. She drops her spindle to the basket and unbuttons her blouse before shrugging her left arm free. And there on her smooth, milky skin is a ghastly bruise, all red and blue, and I can see 5 angry finger marks. Burgess hadn't simply grabbed her, he'd had her arm in a vise, dug into her with his fingernails, yanked. It is a violent mark, and my stomach sours at the sight. I run my hand along the swollen skin, furious at what Burgess did to her, but also thankful for whoever broke his fingers. What happened after the scuffle? I ask.
They kicked him out of the dance, Dolly says. Cyrus and Jonathan and Sam. Several of the others, too. Hauled him out by his arms and legs and pitched him into the snow. He never came back in.
I clear my throat so the girls won't hear the emotion in my voice. It wasn't your fault, Hannah. You don't owe anyone a dance, or anything else. You were right to turn Burgess down, and Cyrus was right to thrash him for touching you.
Oh God, the thought assails me as I step into my workroom to put my things away.
What else did Cyrus do to Burgess last night? Once I have settled myself, I go back to the main hearth, where a large cast iron kettle hangs over the fire. I ladle a bowl of stew for Sam Dalwin.
Bread's ready too,
Dolly points at several oblong mounds set on the counter and covered with linen towels. I add a thick slab of warm bread, covered with 3 pats of butter, to the tray and go to speak with our patient. I don't knock or announce my presence, and when I push against the door, it swings open with a soft groan. Startled, Sam sits bolt upright, mouth open, hair wild, looking much like a drowned man himself. He grips the bedclothes so hard his knuckles turn white. Sam is a bit worse for wear after his plunge into the river. His face and hands are scratched, and his right shoulder is badly bruised.
Mistress Ballard, he offers a polite nod of greeting. It's good to see you alive, I say cheerfully.
Sam settles back against the headboard and pulls the blanket up around his bare chest as though embarrassed, as though half the people in this house hadn't already seen him wearing only the skin God gave him. He could use a shave, a haircut, and a full night's rest. But other than that, Sam is in decent shape. He's a good height with a strong back, and even though his auburn hair would be more becoming on a woman, he usually manages to look ruddy instead of sunburned.
I did fear for a minute I was dead, he says.
You were close, or so I've heard. I set the tray on the end of the bed and step back. Hungry?
Very much, thank you.
Sam bends forward to grab the tray and slides it onto his lap. He must have caught sight of one of the girls through the open door because he glares at something over my shoulder.
May I have my clothes? I'd like to go home.
I have never met a grown man who, when thwarted like a child, doesn't act like one. His pinched eyebrows give him the petulant look of a toddler, and I stifle a laugh. Of course. I believe they're dry now, I tell him. Sam plunges his spoon into the stew, but stops with it halfway to his mouth, when I add, but there's one thing you can help me with. Before you leave, if you don't mind.
What would that be?
I shut the door, then cross the room and lower myself to the wooden chest that sits below the window. I fold my hands in my lap and give him a reassuring smile. I'd like to know what exactly you saw under the ice this morning. He draws back with a flinch, and stew sloshes over the edge of his spoon and back into the bowl with a tiny plop. Some look, horror or fear, or maybe disgust, flashes through his eyes.
But then Sam lowers his head and studies his food, hiding whatever he feels.
Why would you want to know a thing like that?
I've just come from the tavern.
He looks up at me sharply,
and I add, they called me to examine the body. But it would also help to know what you saw under the ice.
A dead man, but you know that already.
Yes, but could you tell who it was? He hesitates, the muscles along his jaw straining as he clenches his teeth.
Not at first. It was dark. The sun hadn't come up.
But not so dark that you mistook him for a log or debris. You knew it was a person.
Well, his face was there, an inch or so below the surface of the ice, staring right at me when they pulled me out. I couldn't see much under the water, just a tangled form of some kind. But out of the river, it was obvious enough.
And did you recognize him then?
I've seen Burgess often enough to know his face.
He was hanged, Sam. He swallows hard.
Who?
I can think of a few people who'd like to see him dead. He studies me for a moment before asking the obvious question.
Like Joseph North? I lean forward and rest my elbows on my knees.
That will be hard to prove without the rope. I asked at the tavern, but no one saw a rope when they cut him from the ice. Was there anything in the water, anything at all that you remember?
No.
Whatever appetite Sam Darwin might have had evaporates. He drops his spoon back into the bowl and pushes the tray away.
I am grateful for your kindness, Mistress Ballard, I truly am, but I'd like to go see May now. She's probably worried half to death.
When Jonathan returns from telling May Kimball about the accident, I step outside to speak with him. He has just pulled the wagon up to the garden gate and stepped down from the seat when he sees me.
I've come to take Sam home, he says.
What happened last night? Like half my children, Jonathan has his father's eyes, and I see the flash of terror in that deep, clear blue, but only for a moment, only until he shudders the expression and locks me out.
He fell through the ice.
I mean at the frolic with Cyrus. It's been a full day, at least, since Jonathan has slept, and everything about how he pushes through the gate says he's not in the mood to talk, but he knows I won't let him pass without an answer of some sort.
Burgess wasn't invited, but he came and caused a scene, and we handled it.
Well, Burgess is dead now, and I'm going to need a better answer than that. My son is 26 years old, a man grown, bearded, and strong, but I am his mother, and I know every expression his face can form. The way he avoids showing emotion by breaking eye contact, the way he sets his jaw when troubled, and cries only in private. I know it all. And in the end, exhausted though he may be, Jonathan's will is no match for mine.
He touched Hannah.
I know, she told me. He relaxes a bit then, and I ask, everyone saw the fight?
Was impossible not to. Happened in the middle of the dance floor, and the music stopped, and everyone crowded round. But he was alive when we kicked him out. You can ask anyone that was there.
People will ask, you know that, right? So you have to tell me everything.
There's nothing else to tell.
It's not that I don't believe Jonathan. I just have the sense he's giving me only half the story. But pressing him further will do no good. He needs to get Sam home. He needs a hot meal and a warm bed and a full night's sleep. And perhaps after those things, he'll be more forthcoming with the details. Sam Darwin rescues him by stepping out the front door. He is dressed and haggard, but he politely tips his hat in farewell.
Thank ye again, Mistress Ballard. I am in your family's debt.
I pat his cheek. Nonsense. I'm glad you're safe. Please give my regards to May. Once Sam and Jonathan leave, I go back inside and retreat to my workroom. It sits off the kitchen, and the sun slants through the windows, illuminating the rows of dried herbs that hang from the ceiling. Shelves filled with bottles and little linen sacks, each carefully labeled, line one wall. There are boxes and baskets everywhere. A long workbench littered with other concoctions from my garden in various stages of fermentation and dehydration. A mortar and pestle, rolls of twine, bits and bobs, corks, a scale. And there on the hearth, a small kettle for boiling roots. There is a rectangular wooden box with leather hinges, long since brittle and cracked with age, sitting in the middle of the work table. Sharp, slender knives and smooth, round stones. This is my apothecary, my sanctuary, and it smells of lavender and wood smoke, basil and vetiver, mint, catnip, lemongrass. Situated just so on the side of the house, thanks to good planning on Ephraim's part, it catches light from sunrise to sunset. I make my way to a small wooden desk before the eastern window and settle onto the stool that Ephraim built to accommodate my unusual height. Barefoot, I can almost look my husband in the eye. And though there are many things he loves about me, this is foremost. What a strange beginning to this new day, I think. Then take a long breath through my nose, letting the fragrant herbs settle me. I am certain there will be no retreat from whatever comes next. But at least I have a few moments' peace to record my thoughts on everything that has happened in the last few hours. A large leather-bound journal sits at the corner of my desk, and I pull it closer. 3 times a year, my husband orders cakes of ink from a stationery shop in Boston. They come 2 to a box, pressed into small round discs, with the word Larkin stamped on top. It costs Ephraim 5 shillings for the ink and 1 for the postage, but he pays it gladly, even though he says Ebenezer Larkin has a foul mouth and a fondness for whores. This is how Ephraim shows his devotion, making sure that I always have something with which to write. On our wedding night, many years ago, he gave me the first leather journal, identical to the one on my desk now. He said it was a place to keep my thoughts together in one place, and his only request was that I not let it sit empty. I have filled 12 of them since. The books themselves are easier to come by than the ink, and it isn't uncommon for Ephraim to return from a trip to Boston with a new volume filled with blank, stiff pages. I find them on my stool, often with a pressed flower tucked between the pages. Those flowers, now dried, remain exactly where he placed them, while the books themselves reside on a shelf across the room. I keep up with the journals because I enjoy it, but also because it is my job, one of the duties of my profession. As a midwife and healer, I am witness to the details of my neighbors' private lives, along with their fears and secrets, and, when appropriate, I record them for safekeeping. Memory is a wicked thing that warps and twists, but paper and ink receive the truth without emotion, and they read it back without partiality. That, I believe, is why so few women are taught to read and write. God only knows what they would do with the power of pen and ink at their disposal. I am not God, nor do I desire to be, but being privy to much of what goes on behind closed doors in this town, I have a rather good idea what secrets might be recorded, then later revealed if more women took up the pen. I suspect that I will need to remember the events of this morning, so I reach for quill and ink. The journal is spread open to yesterday's entry. As is my habit, I began with the weather, but left the rest of the entry blank so that I might fill it in later. Wednesday, November 25. Clear and cold. The ice runs in the river. I break off a piece of ink cake and mix it with water in a small silver dish, the bottom of which is stamped with an image of a man astride a horse. Below it are engraved the words, Paul Revere Silver, Boston. Another gift from Ephraim. Another bit of extravagance, though this one rather personal. My husband and Mr. Revere formed a friendship of sorts during the Revolution, and the silversmith has never forgotten him as a result. I dip the quill, tap it twice on the edge of the dish to knock off the excess ink, and continue the entry. Cyrus, Jonathan, Hannah, and Dolly attended a frolic at the home of May Kimball, got home late. Then Jonathan set out for Longreach with a raft of boards, Sam Dalwin and James Wall with him. I lift the quill from the page, pausing. The room is no longer cold, so I can't account for the shiver that crawls up my spine. It's only that fox, I think, and look out the window to where I last saw the little beast. She is long gone, and daylight has chased all the menacing shadows from the woods, but I still feel something looming in the distance, a portent of some kind. Don't be a fool, Martha Ballard, I mutter, then lower both eyes and quill. Before long, the gentle scratching continues. Thursday, November 26. Clear and very cold. Birth. Charles Clark's third daughter. I was called by Mr. Cowan to attend Betsy Clark, who was in travail, at the second hour this morning. She was safe delivered of a daughter, her third child, all daughters, at the fourth hour. I left her cleverly and was conducted to Mr. Pollard's. I am informed that Jonathan and others were attempting to go down with a raft and were enclosed by the ice at Bumberhook Point. The ice makes very fast. Sam Dalwin fell through as he was attempting to go to shore, but was saved. My hand hovers above the page, and I am about to record the death of Joshua Burgess, but something scratches at the back of my mind, like a tiny itch that I can't reach. So I flip backward in the diary, searching for an entry that I made last month. There are no page numbers in my book, but that never stops me from finding an old entry when I need to. The thing about setting ink to paper is that it allows me to remember which side I've written on and where along the page an entry lies. I remember ink blots and words I have struck through, errors and misspellings. Even now, I can see the entry in my mind, see that the top left corner of the page has been torn off, and that there is a smudge in the margin. Recalling those details, it is easy enough to locate. Thursday, October 1. Clear, except some showers. We had company this afternoon. Mr. Savage here informs us that Mrs. Foster has sworn a rape on a number of men, among whom is Joseph North. Shocking indeed. I have been at home. Oh, God, I think, sitting upright on my stool. I have to tell Rebecca before someone else does. The fact that I refuse to ride side saddle or pillion has long since ceased to astonish our neighbors. Such arrangements are neither practical nor timely given how often I am summoned to one emergency or another. There is no use in being ladylike when lives depend on my speedy arrival. Once I have changed back into my riding outfit, a brushed twill skirt with two rows of buttons that, depending on how they are configured, can transform the garment into wide-leg trousers, I go to the barn to saddle Brutus. Cyrus is there. For a moment, I think it's Ephraim, so alike are they from behind. And then he turns and I see the beard. He catches sight of me in his periphery and startles. But in the time it takes me to blink, his unease is replaced by a quick smile that reaches all the way to his hazel eyes. Then he winces, and I see the split lip, the bruised eye. Though I know he doesn't want me to, I gently set my hand to his face and turn it this way and that, inspecting him. Cyrus rolls his eyes, sighs, but allows my ministrations. Nothing is broken, no need for stitches. So I let him go and step back. These grown boys of mine will allow mothering only in small doses. When did you get home? I ask. He shrugs, as though time is a construct of little interest to him. And perhaps it is. We do not own a clock, but each and every Ballard, myself included, has an instinct for time, a certainty learned by the angle of the sun and the length of shadows. Even in winter, even with nothing to work by other than heavy cloud cover and opaque light, time is a thing we feel, and our days are ordered accordingly. Brutus hangs his head over the stall door and snorts, as though he knows exactly why I've come, as though he is displeased to see me. I have to take him out again, I tell Cyrus with a frown. I'm sure he'll be an ass about it. He looks to where Sterling is grazing happily in his stall, placid as always, and I know what he's thinking. No, I say, Brutus has to get used to me, and riding him is the only way to make that happen. When I move toward the tack room, Cyrus waves me away. I watch my oldest son grab the bridle and lead Brutus from his stall. I watch him methodically saddle my horse, testing the buckles exactly the way his father taught him. This is a new thing, his desire to coddle me, to protect. I find it irritating and intrusive. He is beginning to think of me as old. As soon as Brutus is ready, I take the reins. I know what happened at the frolic. Those beautiful hazel eyes narrow. He is wary. And now Joshua Burgess is dead. Jonathan and Sam found him in the river this morning. Cyrus stumbles backward as though I've slapped him. He lifts his hands, palms out, as though to say he had nothing to do with that. I know, but when I get back, you are going to tell me everything. The Parsonage. In hindsight, I should have bought a fat, lazy horse who likes apples, sugar cubes, and sleeping in the sun. Instead, I purchased Brutus, a 6-year-old buckskin stallion, every bit as charming as his name, from one of the Boston militiamen who camped in Hollowell last year. The man could no longer ride thanks to a broken leg, and I only thought to ask how he had been injured after I'd handed over payment. Brutus had thrown the man a week before I bought him, and he has thrown me 3 times since, twice into a briar patch and once in the river. I swear to God Almighty, I mutter under my breath as we canter away from the barn. If you pitch me onto the frozen ground, I will have you turned into glue within a fortnight. Brutus whickers in response, and from the way his muscles roil beneath my calves, I fear he is going to bolt or buck. I give a warning tug at the bit, and he snorts in contempt, then settles beneath me. I answer with a low growl, and we both accept the draw. I suppose I can't blame him. If I'd been pulled away from a meal, I'd be angry too. But Brutus has a single job, to get me where I need to go. And I will not be ordered about by the whims of a horse who is in fact little more than an adolescent. I've dealt with the likes of him before. Still, our mission this afternoon is not a happy one, and I hate being the bearer of bad news. Although in this case, bad might be the wrong word. Disturbing, tawdry, barbaric, crass. Any of those options might fit seeing as how it isn't exactly bad news I have come to deliver. I felt nothing but relief when I saw Joshua Burgess on that table earlier today. Rebecca Foster might feel differently, however, and I steel myself for whatever her reaction may be. The home of Isaac and Rebecca Foster is a simple stone cottage set back from Water Street on a narrow rhododendron-lined drive. Behind it lies a small barn and a garden. They do not own any of this, however. The parsonage and all the outbuildings belong to the town and are leased to them for a pittance as part of Isaac's salary as pastor. The fact that he was dismissed from his position 5 months ago makes their continued residence a point of contention among their detractors. A tall young woman with hazel eyes and a lovely, plump figure answers on the third knock and invites me inside. Good morning, Sally. Is Rebecca home?
Aye, Mistress Ballard. I'll tell her you're here.
She turns on her heel and swishes away, leaving me to hang my riding cloak on the hook beside the door. The girl is back in less than a minute, and I marvel at the way she can avoid eye contact even when looking directly at me. Somehow her gaze seems to float over my shoulder as though searching for something in the distance.
This way, Mistress Ballard. She's having tea in the parlor.
Given that the parsonage has only a handful of rooms, parlor is a loose term for the only extra sitting area in the home. But it does have a cozy fireplace, a window, and a door of its own. Sally ushers me in, then slips away to continue feeding the foster boys their lunch. I can hear them in the kitchen, squabbling over the last piece of toast. Rebecca is not the sort of woman who is comfortable having domestic help, but it is one of the things required of her as the minister's wife. Sally came with the parsonage and is the latest Pierce daughter to fill the position. Two of her sisters had the honor previously. The girl is tolerated, but not exactly welcome, in no small part because she is known to hover around corners and report what she hears back to her mother. Bonnie Pierce prides herself on knowing all that happens in Hollowell. Every town has a gossip, and in ours the title belongs to her. Rebecca sits in a rocking chair by the fire, a blanket across her lap, and a steaming cup of tea in her hands. A long, thick, golden braid hangs over one shoulder. When I walk in, she takes the pile of knitting from her lap and moves it to a basket beside the hearth. I kiss her lightly on the brow and take the opposite rocking chair. It is good to see you. And you. Rebecca tips her head to the side and listens as the faint retreating footsteps of Sally Pierce and her children move upstairs, followed by a burst of laughter. I am so thankful that girl is only here a few hours each morning. Most women would be glad of the help, I say, with a teasing smile. I shouldn't be so unkind, she sighs. Sally will repeat what I've said. If not to Isaac himself, then certainly to her mother. Half the town already considers me an ingrate. I hesitate, unwilling to lie. The truth is that half of Hollowell thinks far worse of her than that. They will understand you soon enough, I tell her, and you will have your apologies then. We are only talking in circles, but a shadow falls over Rebecca's face, and I wish that I were here under different circumstances. But still, pleasantries must be observed. Would you like some tea? Rebecca leans forward toward a small table between the rocking chairs. A tea service is laid out in the middle, and steam rises from the pot. That would be lovely. I'll go get another cup. Rebecca glides elegantly from the room, so different from the way she moved 3 months ago, when I found her in this very parlor a few days after Joshua Burgess and Joseph North attacked her. I shake the image from my mind and stand so that I can warm my hands in front of the fire. There is a small tin on the mantel, and I pick it up, admiring the tea roses painted on each side. The lid is off, and a bitter scent rises from inside. I sniff, then draw back with a scowl as the acrid odor floods my nostrils. The disagreeable turpentine-like smell is unmistakable. Savin. A second whiff reveals something cleaner and sweet, almost floral with a hint of camphor. Tansy. I set the tin back and return to my chair, then lift the teapot to my nose just to make sure. Black tea, plain and simple. It's a bit weak, Rebecca says from the doorway, with a note of apology in her voice. I don't seem to have the stomach for anything strong these days. I'm sure it's fine. We sit in companionable silence while Rebecca prepares the tea. One sugar cube, a splash of milk, two quick stirs with the spoon. The warmth feels good against my cold fingers when Rebecca hands me the cup. Formalities completed, we can move on to the real purpose of this visit. She looks at me over the rim of her cup, hesitant. You were in the Hook early today. I nod. I was called to the tavern on business, and I have a bit of news that concerns you. Good or bad, I can't tell by the tone of your voice. Both, actually. I turn to the parlor door, noting that Rebecca left it half open. Sally and the boys are still occupied. I can hear footsteps in the room above and the creak of a rocking chair. Where is Isaac? In his study, writing another letter to the congregational church leaders in Boston to contest his dismissal. Even after the last two failed to reinstate him? A wry smile bends the corner of her mouth. My husband is an eternal optimist. I would have said pig-headed had I been the one to describe him. Isaac is currently suing Hollowell for $200. His contract with the town as preacher was for 5 years, and he claims that his firing violated that contract and that he is due the remainder of the money promised. To say that things have grown contentious as a result would be an understatement. He refuses to leave the town, much less the parsonage, until the lawsuit has been resolved. Isaac Foster is a man of books, of belief, of rules and fairness. And for a moment, I consider calling him in to hear this news, but decide against it. Rebecca should not have to weigh his reaction when expressing her own. Despite what happened in August, there is still something in her soft brown eyes, a cheerfulness and curiosity that reminds me of the daughters I lost so many years ago. It's what drew me to Rebecca in the first place. Every interaction with her since has made me wonder what my daughters would be doing now had they survived that long, horrid summer. She cups her tea in both hands and holds it to her lips, letting the steam curl around her cheeks before taking a sip. So what is this news you have for me? Instead of answering Rebecca's question, I once again look to the door, listen for a beat, then ask one of my own. Do you happen to know where Isaac was last night? I don't. In his study, I suppose. But I wasn't feeling well and I went to bed early. Why? I can remember a time when my sons were younger, when they loved throwing stones over the bridge into the river. They loved the splash and the noise. Being boys, they loved the disturbance that it caused. I study Rebecca's face and take no pleasure in upsetting the still waters of her soul. Joshua Burgess is dead. They found his body in the river this morning. Rebecca shakes her head as though unable to comprehend. Whatever questions she means to ask won't form. It was not an accident. He didn't drown, I tell her. He was hanged. Rebecca goes completely still, except for her hands, which begin a frantic trembling. I watch the amber liquid slosh back and forth in her delicate teacup, this way and that, and I pluck it from her hands before she can dump the contents into her lap. I wait for her to speak. The reason I believe her account of what happened in August has as much to do with our long-standing friendship as it does with the small traumatizing details that make up the bedrock of her story. Joshua Burgess has a rasp to his voice. You've heard it, she finally asks, then looks at me. But her eyes are glassy and unfocused, and it is clear that she is elsewhere, in the past. An image of that white, waxy windpipe flashes across my mind. Yes, he did, but not anymore. Rebecca squeezes her eyes shut, blocking out some memory of her own. When she speaks again, her voice wavers. He ripped off the lace hem of my shift before he started. He tied his hair back. Why do I remember that so clearly? He's dead now, Rebecca. That's what I'm trying to tell you. He can't ever hurt you again.
North can.
I want to deny this, but we both know there are endless ways that Joseph North can continue to wound Rebecca without ever touching her again. Not the least is through his continued denials and subtle attacks on her character and reputation. That has been going on for 2 months now. I'm not going to let that happen. I'm going to Vassalboro next month. I will be right there with you in court, and I will give my testimony. Everyone will know what he did, and you will have your justice. When I found Rebecca after the attack, it took her almost 2 hours to explain why her face and arms were battered with fading angry bruises, and why her lip had been split. But she has no such hesitation now. Her words come fast and breathless.
I'm glad Burgess is dead.
I am too.
And I hope Isaac did kill him.
It's my turn to be startled, and a glug of warm tea splashes over the rim of my cup, across my thumb, and into the cuff of my sleeve. Shh, you can't say that.
Am I not allowed to want vengeance?
Of course. But his body is still at the tavern. There will be an investigation, and can you imagine what will happen if Isaac is accused? Besides, you do have your vengeance, at least one half of it anyway.
No, she says. I will never be free of what they did to me.
I cannot argue this, nor do I try. Instead, I reach for her hand, and we finish our tea in silence, watching the hypnotic dance of flames in the fireplace. Later, when the shadows have shifted and the coals settle in the hearth, I set down my empty cup, kiss Rebecca on the brow once more, and whisper my goodbyes. Only when I reach the parlor door does she speak again.
Martha?
I look over my shoulder. Yes?
I haven't bled since July.
My lips form an O of surprise, and I return to her side, placing my hands on each of her shoulders. I can feel the little knobs of bone beneath each palm. Are you telling me that you are with child?
I've had the boys. I know what it feels like.
Is there any chance at all it could be Isaac's? Rebecca shakes her head.
We haven't gone to bed since before he went to Boston, and he hasn't touched me since. There is no way it can be his.
When was the last time you bled?
The end of July, after Isaac left.
4 months. Long enough for a child to take root. Have you told him?
No, but I think he's guessed. I am so sorry,
I whisper, pulling Rebecca to my chest. Only this time there is no weeping, no anguish. There is only a vacant stillness, a void where the spirit of my friend once resided. I pull away and lower one hand to Rebecca's belly. The small, firm mound is easy to find. I press gently this way and that, just to make sure, but there is no doubt. Rebecca Foster is a slender woman. Soon there will be no hiding it at all.
I don't know what to do,
she whispers, her eyes wide and brown, the color of tea. They are swimming with tears. You don't have to. Not today.